Several times in my life, I have witnessed the effect of rubble on progress. Many ancient civilizations have been rubbled over. In order to build the next stage of culture to occupy that space, this rubbling over is often expedient for the moment. It can show very little regard, however, for what has gone before. Cultures soon can be forgotten. If you were to go to Israel today, you would come across the effect of a law. And that law is that whenever the earth is dug and some potential pre-existent structure is touched on, the site must be archaeologically studied before moving ahead. That has gotten in the way of a lot of farmers. It's amazing the finds, however, that are there. Ancient towns unearthed, synagogue floors found, mosaics of particular magnificence, once buried in dust and sand. If you go to Italy, you'll find that there's similar laws, and they've unburied many of the most ancient sites in Rome and beyond. In Lower Manhattan is the African Burial Ground National Monument, a relatively recent monument by American standards, I suppose. It marks the original burial site in what was then outside the city wall of New Amsterdam and then New York, where the burial of free and enslaved Africans was permitted. 10,000 to 20,000 were buried there, it seems. They were buried layer after layer over each other. Then in the 1800s, it was simply rubbled over and landfilled so that the city could continue to grow uninhibited by the burial ground. That tells us much about the social positioning of Africans at that point in time. And that tells us also what we think or thought of them in that time. At least two generations of buildings have occupied this spot. Homes, which yielded then to government buildings and to department stores. In 1991, the federal government acquired the land to expand the federal building that was there. And the remains of whole body skeletons began to be unearthed. Long story short, public pressure caused the government, rather reluctant at first, to redesign what it intended and to pay attention to the remains and to the story and the history of those remains, to redraw the planned building so that it had a smaller footprint and could leave an ample memorial to the cemetery and the historic contribution of free and enslaved Africans to the early founding and prospering of this nation and that city. The lesson buried and unearthed here is that rubble, the remains of the past, is seldom just rubble. It may well be a wealth of history and culture, things better and things worse. Wisdoms can be found in seeing what's contained in the rubble, what is important, what is not, what is of joy, what is of sorrow. How might it instruct our living? That's its question. Who am I in light of what I know? We hear something of this reflection in the psalmist who says, when we restore, then are we like those who dream anew. The words of Isaiah today are beautiful words of hope. And they were written in a time where joy and sorrow touched. all the strength of Israel had been taken away. It was 70 years since the Babylonian captivity began, and all the strength and wealth and beauty of Israel was simply moved, and the cities and the homes destroyed. Now, in this third Isaiah passage, they are returning or have returned to Jerusalem, and it is in rubble. The sacred and the secular houses of hope and pride that their parents told them of, they are now just ruins. So there was hope in returning, but there was despair in the sighting and struggle to rebuild from that rubble. And yet the song of faith and hope bursts forth from the mouth of Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captive and release to the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Jesus will one day use these words of hope as he initiates his own public ministry. But for now, they belong to Israel, Israel's longing and Israel's hope. Isaiah describes a time of full restoration, a time when the Jubilee will finally commence, a time when what is just and what is honest and what is upright will gain the sway of the day. They are to grow into a people recognizable as those who are blessed by God, a sign for all the other nations. And as they now sift through the rubble of Jerusalem, finding stones worthy of lifting up and putting in place again, they're invited to sift more deeply, to remember that God has called them to something bigger and better than this moment and even this task that's now at hand, to create a society that praises God, that lives justly, that seeks what is righteous. It is so easy when you are sifting rubble or old bones to forget that sometimes there is a hope, a dream of good that's waiting to be found there. That was the importance of sifting through the landfill in Lower Manhattan off of Broadway. Here lay buried, deliberately forgotten, a story, the legacy of Africans who had helped literally to lay the foundations of American life. And there were interesting, if horrific, facts buried there. 6,000 plus being children who did not acquire the age of 2 and by their bones died of malnutrition, who died by neglect while their parents were forced labor. Here lay now 9,000 plus adults who, while being held of low regard, were essential to the making of New York that was growing now above the ground. Here lay a story that we can at least honor by proper deference what has gone before. Perhaps here lay a reminder that we are, as a nation, are called to better. Surely we as church are. How do we always call forth hope? That's a question that lingers. And the answer has usually to do with looking deeper, not necessarily at what is easy, but where the meaning lies. As Advent's admitted call to face the darkness of life with hope prepares soon to shift to Christmas, where we celebrate God's most deliberate plan to live in our flesh, to show us how a godly life occupies flesh, we may well be called to sift through personal and cultural rubble to find new hope. That's God's intent. As all these women of late have found their inner resource to name the misuse of God's created attraction between the genders, coupled with power, and how it has marred their lives, what are we to make of this rubble? Once we prosecute what's required or allows prosecution, what more are we to make of it? In this rubble, perhaps, we will find ways to speak more deeply to ourselves, to converse with our children as they move towards adulthood and its responsibilities. Perhaps we will think again about God's priority, that we see one another as children of God, made to reflect good to each other, and how we do that in relationships that involve power and work and even play. This is but one area of current culture that bids our attention. You perhaps have your own list, your own observances around you. Into Advent, John the Baptist annually comes. John's gospel tells us that he came as a witness to testify to the light. Himself was not the light, only that he came to testify to the light. And the religious of his day want to know, but who are you? Are you the Messiah? No. Are you Elijah then, the sign of the Messiah to come? No. Are you one of the other prophets? No. Who then? I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord. Perhaps this is the last lesson that we need to take in on this third Sunday of Advent. The church and her people, as much as we might want to save the culture, when it is turning to rubble or discovering our corporate sin, we might have a word of wisdom, but we are not the Messiah. We might have a prophetic word, and I hope we do, but we are not the final prophet. We are very often at our best, the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make straight the ways of the Lord. And we do that best when we enflesh the corporal works of mercy, things that we have seen in Jesus, to feed the hungry, to give drink to the thirsty, to clothe the poor and the naked, to give shelter to the homeless, to visit the sick and those imprisoned, to ransom the captive, and to bury the dead. Or when we engage in some of the spiritual works of mercy, to teach the ignorant, to counsel the doubtful, to console the sad, to confront the sinner, to forgive the offender, to bear with the oppressive and the troublesome, and always, always to pray. When we give ourselves to these things, our voice in the wilderness becomes visible in our very actions. And potentially, we are creating a birthplace for the Christ, that he may once again find a soft landing